Hello and welcome, everyone. This is Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and we are here for our micronutrients presentation. And today's topic is vitamin B5, also known as pantothenic acid. I'm excited to talk about this vitamin because it's so integral to energy production and adrenal health and hormone health. It's super, super important. And what I'm going to do in this presentation is share with you how. Give you a little behind the scenes. It's one thing to go to a list and say, what is this vitamin good for? What is this mineral good for? And memorize it. But it's yet another to have an understanding of the pathways and the various reactions it's involved in, because that allows you to think on your feet when you're talking to someone and they explain certain conditions or symptoms. So that's what I want you to get to. So I want to make sure that you're aware that this information is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified medical professional. And for you guys, when you're talking to people, is make sure that you make your clients and patients aware of that. Well, if you're patients and they're in a doctor-patient relationship, it's different. But if you're in a coaching relationship, and if you're an MD or DC or an ND who has a license to be working with people and do medical advice, you also need to be aware that once you cross state lines and you're on the phone with them or Skype with them, that may not be the case. So I would think of them as clients or talk to them about as clients, and it's not medical advice because they may have another medical professional that they're working with if they're talking to you over the phone. It's just knowledge, my experience, my research all goes into this. And you always want to encourage people, and you for yourself as well, is to bounce this off if they're under the care of a doctor, bounce it off the doctor. So here's our map. We've got all of our B vitamins. Today's talk is on pantothenic acid. It's vitamin B5. And the general stuff, it's related to coenzyme A, it's related to the adrenals, and it's related to skin health. And we'll talk about why. So the general information about it, it's a B vitamin, therefore it's in the water-soluble category. The other names are pantothenic acid, but pantothenate. That's for the free form of the vitamin. We'll see as we go through that there are a couple of other forms that are not free that are slightly different in structure. But that's the pure form of vitamin B5, pantothenic acid or pantothenate. It consists of what's a beta-alanine and a pantoic acid rings joined together by a peptide bond. So we'll see that when we look at the structure. Interestingly enough, the name is derived from the Greek word panthos, meaning everywhere. And as it turns out, vitamin B5 is present all over. It's virtually every food, animal, plant, kingdom, etc. It's found all over. And the biggest thing that its function comes from is that it's part of the coenzyme A. So we have other groups that we tack on to pantothenic acid to make coenzyme A. So that's its cofactor form. Most vitamins have cofactor forms. So let's look at its chemical structure. The two pictures at the top and the bottom are the same. It's the same structure, but I just thought I'd give you the 3D version of it since I found a slide like that right there in the bottom. So we're basically, it's got a couple of alcohol groups at each end. That's the OH. It's got some a methyl group in there, two methyl groups. And it's got a couple of double bonded oxygens. And so it's got three alcohol groups. It's got two methyl groups and two double bonds to oxygen. So, it's a simple vitamin compared to something like vitamin B12, but it's very powerful.
Let's have a look at the coenzyme form of vitamin B5, which is the most abundant that you're going to see in nature, in foods, and also the active form in the body in most reactions. So what you've got is a combination of coenzyme A, which has pantothenic acid at its core, and an acetyl group to form acetyl-CoA. On either side of the pantothenic acid, you've got some extra atoms and molecules. You've got phosphorus groups, and you've got cysteine, the amino acid cysteine over on the right. Then you've got the acetyl group, and then a combination of sulfur, nitrogen, and carbon and hydrogen on the left. So this combination all put together is acetyl-CoA. Now let's take a look at how that's actually created in the body so you get a sense of how complex that is. So the synthesis of CoA from pantothenic acid starts out with a kinase, a pantothenic acid kinase, to form from pantothenic acid 4-phosphopantothenic acid. So we're adding on a phosphorus group through a kinase enzyme. You see the steps listed here. The second step is where a cysteine is added to the 4-phosphopantothenate by another synthetase enzyme, which has a long name, phosphopantothenosylcysteine. And that forms 4'-phospho-N-pantothenylcysteine. And what that looks like is here. Now, I don't expect you to remember all these reactions. I just want you to see that it's a complex process that requires a lot of energy and amino acids and phosphorus to create. So you've got that, and it's forming this 4-phosphopantothenylcysteine. So it's got the amino acid cysteine tacked onto it. From there, we have another reaction, which is a decarboxylase enzyme, 4-phosphopantothenic acid decarboxylase, which takes it to 4-phosphopantothene. Okay, so looking at here, it's decarboxylated by phosphopantothenylcysteine decarboxylase to 4'-phosphopantothene. The next step is the 4'-phosphopantothene is adenylated to form D-phospho-CoA by an enzyme called phosphopantothenidine adenyl transferase. And what that looks like is this step here. We get this step here, and then the final step is where we have that dephospho-CoA kinase, which takes it down to the CoA form. So all of that just to say this is a complex process. Pantothenic acid is at the heart and the core of acetyl-CoA. Acetyl-CoA is very, very useful in many, many reactions in the body, and we're going to take a look at what some of those are in just a moment.
So let's look at some of the fun stuff. So the absorption, it's pretty simple compared to some of the others. It occurs in free and bound forms in food, but in 85% of the foods, it's actually bound in a form called CoA. It's absorbed mainly in the jejunum. You know that some of the other vitamins are absorbed further up, some absorbed in the stomach as well as the jejunum, but it's absorbed mainly in the jejunum. And like most other water-soluble vitamins, when there's a high concentration, if somebody is taking a lot of it as a supplement, it goes through the lining as passive diffusion, meaning there's no energy involved. It's just a gradient flow. So you've got more in the intestinal lumen, less in the cells, and it flows in. When there's a low concentration, though, there's a sodium-dependent carrier that takes it across. Usually those carriers are protein. And in this case, it's not one that just takes across the B5, it takes across other vitamins. So once it's in the body, absorbed into the body, it's hydrolyzed to a substance called pantothene. Pantothene is a version of pantothenic acid. It's a slightly different in structure, but pantothene is actually the part that is made into CoA. So on the other end, when we're taking it apart in the intestine, so if you have CoA, it's hydrolyzed to pantothene, and then it goes down to pantothenic acid by enzymes called phosphatases and pyrophosphatases. So in other words, the pantothene is the important part, and you can actually have people taking pantothene versus pantothenic acid. And when we talk about the uses later, you'll see that certain of the functions that pantothenic acid, vitamin B5, does, you get a better result, a different result when you have them take pantothene. That could be related to the body's inability to activate. So we can think of pantothene as actually the activated form because that's the part that gets incorporated into the CoA. So CoA, as it comes in, remember we said about 85% of the food source is CoA. It has to get broken down to pantothene and then to pantothenic acid. And then it's absorbed. So you might want to ask, why is the body so inefficient that it's breaking it down from the CoA and then it has to put it together later? A lot of the functions in the body do that, where the food comes in as a certain way, it gets broken down, and then it gets restructured. I don't know that anybody's really clear on why that happens, but it happens a lot. But the beauty of it is, if you're taking in an active form, it has all the cofactors and it can be easily put back together. It may have to do with the size. It may have to do with the size of the brush border. It may have to do with the size of the ability of that active transport mechanism to be able to pull across. Not really sure why. Maybe a really deep molecular biologist would know that. The carrier that transports it and carries it into the cells is shared with biotin and lipoic acid. Remember, I said that there was a carrier, and that was a multivitamin carrier. Well, biotin and lipoic acid are the ones that mostly share it with. There's another form of pantothenic acid called panthenol, which is the form that's used in a lot of the multivitamins, and it gets absorbed and converted to pantothenic. So it's, again, that's easily absorbed as is, so that doesn't have to be broken down, but it gets converted to pantothenic acid or pantothenate. If I talk about the two, they're the same. And that's a form in the multivitamins. It's possible that when you have somebody who's taking that form, the pantothenol, that it's not as effective because, again, the body has to break it down. The absorption of pantothenic acid is really important to realize that it decreases to about 10% when the intake exceeds 10 times the recommended intake in pill form. So what that means is that when we're giving people large doses, like 500 milligrams three times a day of B5 for something like adrenal fatigue, then they're only absorbing 10% of that. But they need that. So the 10% would be 50 milligrams three times a day. So you might say, well, why don't I just give them 50 milligrams three times a day? Well, it's because the absorption goes down as the quantity goes up. But if 50 milligrams is what we need for the cells to actually get access to, we have to give them 500. That's just the way it goes. So it's interesting to note the body has these protective mechanisms to try not to overabsorb certain nutrients. So let's talk about the transport and the storage of B5. And I'll interchange between calling it B5, pantothenate, pantothenic acid, but it's all the same stuff. I'm doing that because I want you to get used to hearing it in different ways. So transport and storage. It's absorbed into the intestinal epithelial cells. Those are the cells lining the intestine. It enters the portal circulation. The portal circulation is the circulation from the intestine that goes right to the liver, right? And then the free form is what's carried in the blood. So it's not carried around in the blood as CoA. It has to be recreated into CoA inside the cells. We see higher concentrations in the red blood cells than in the blood serum. What does that mean? Well, that means that if you want to assess somebody's status of pantothenic acid or B5, you can't just do a blood test and see how much is in there, because it doesn't reflect the higher concentrations that are actually occurring intracellularly, so i.e. in the red blood cells. And that can be tested. You can test it in the red blood cells. There's active transport to pull it out of the blood and into the cells of the heart, muscle, brain, and liver, and then passive diffusion into all other tissues. There's the two forms that are found in the cells are 4-phosphopantothenate and then pantothene. So those are the forms that the body is actually putting into the cells. Okay, the most of the pantothenic acid is used to synthesize CoA. That's its main function. And that's done in the liver, the kidney, the adrenal, the brain, and the heart. So this is a really super important vitamin. It doesn't have a lot of widespread functions. It has some very specific functions. And we'll go more into detail on that. So let's look at its roles. Well, it's important for the metabolism of protein, fat, and carbohydrate. It's also a key critical point in the Krebs cycle, so it's important for energy production. It's important for the production of cholesterol, and I'll show you that in a diagram in a minute. It's basically what helps to produce cholesterol, but also producing pregnenolone from cholesterol, so we'll see that in a moment. It's important in the production of adrenal hormones as a result and the production of sex hormones. It's been involved with the production of bile and hemoglobin. It's been shown to reduce inflammation, and that means that it can be good in autoimmune diseases. So there have been some studies that show its role in helping with inflammation in autoimmune disease. It also helps in maintaining healthy levels of blood lipids. So one of the studies I have to share is a couple of studies, actually. They were slightly different levels, but one was 900 milligrams a day, one was 600 milligrams a day. But these studies showed that the cholesterol levels went down, the total, the LDL cholesterol and the HDLs went up, and then the triglycerides went down. So really good for healthy levels of lipids. And then it's also important in methylation, and I have a picture that I'll show you about that, how it's really important with the pantothenic acid in the production of some of the folate derivatives. So it's widespread use, even though it's just got this small little cofactor that it's working with. It's a very important one. You might recognize this picture from the hormone introduction module. But this is basically cholesterol. You've got cholesterol, and you've got B5 pantothenic acid, right? CoA. It's really CoA right there. I was simplified it down to B5, but it's really CoA with B5 being part of it. Now, go back to the studies that said why the B5 will reduce cholesterol. Let's take a look at it. So we've got cholesterol. Cholesterol is supposed to get converted into these sex hormones and these steroid hormones. Okay, but what happens if we don't have enough CoA, acetyl-CoA in this case, in the form and enough pantothenic acid to make acetyl-CoA, is that the cholesterol cannot efficiently be converted down to pregnenolone. So the cholesterol level is going to stay high. So a lot of times when folks come in with elevated cholesterol, we're looking for all kinds of sexy approaches, right? And we think about, well, if they're on statins, we think about what other nutrients can work with statins. But some people think about red yeast rice, and they think about niacin and all sorts of things like that. Well, nobody really talks much about vitamin B5. And especially if you've got somebody who's got adrenal fatigue, they've got high cholesterol, and they're telling you they have sex hormone imbalances like PMS, low libido, menopausal symptoms. You better believe you should be looking at vitamin B5, right? Because the B5 is really super important for converting the cholesterol down to pregnenolone. Make sense? So we go from cholesterol to pantothenic acid using the B5. And the pregnenolone we know is precursor to estrogen, progesterone, DHEA, and cortisol, okay? And aldosterone as well. So not just adrenal fatigue, but elevated cholesterol, but when you start to see the symptom picture, that makes sense. And this is why we go into so much detail about the chemistry. It's because I want you to be able to think on your feet. What's the connection between cholesterol and vitamin B5? Well, and I believe it has to do with the steroid synthesis right here, right there in front of you.
Now let's turn our attention to some of the functions of pantothenic acid and acetyl-CoA in the body. Let's start with acetylation and proteins. Coenzyme A was first named for its role in acetylation reactions, and that's basically the adding of an acetate group onto a chemical compound. When proteins are acetylated, it alters their overall charge, their three-dimensional structure, and their function. Some of the things that acetylation will do would be to regulate the activity of peptide hormones, so hormones made from amino acids, groups of amino acids called peptides, including those produced by the pituitary gland. So it has a major role in the effect of hormones. It regulates the function and the half-life of some signaling molecules, transcription factors, and enzymes. What that means is that those signaling molecules, it's going to affect the communication between the various parts of the body. Also, transcription factors has to do with DNA and RNA and the expression of genes. And then enzymes, which of course affects just about everything in the body because enzymes are cofactors that catalyze specific reactions. They're not cofactors, they're actually the enzymes that catalyze specific reactions, chemical reactions in the body. Histones, which play a role in the regulation of gene expression, When they become acetylated, that facilitates transcription. So you can see that acetylation of proteins is a super important role, and it's one that pantothenic acid in the form of coenzyme A facilitates. We also have acetylation and lipids. Acetylation is important to form sphingolipids, which form part of the myelin sheath, phospholipids, which protect the brain and the nervous system tissues, as well as helping with memory functions, and also fatty acids. There's an enzyme called fatty acid synthase, which requires pantothenic acid, the acyl carrier protein, in the form of 4-phosphopantothene. So in order for this fatty acid synthase enzyme to work, it requires pantothenic acid, which means that the interconversion from, say, essential fats to the non-essential fats that the body should be able to do, it's not going to do as efficiently in the absence of pantothenic acid. So these all imply the widespread effect of vitamin B5, pantothenic acid, on the nervous system and cognition. Acetyl-CoA, malonyl-CoA, and ACP are all required for the synthesis of fatty acids. So it's not just the acetyl carrier protein. It's the other forms of CoA that are important for making sure that these fatty acids do get synthesized. And fatty acid synthesis stops, we kind of lose functioning in the body. 4-phosphopantothene is required for the 10-formyl tetrahydrofolate dehydrogenase enzyme, which is needed to form tetrahydrofolate, which is the active form of folate. And it's essential in the formation of nucleic acids and the formation of blood cells, red blood cells, and amino acids. So you could see that there's a lot of interaction between the various pieces of the body and vitamin B5. Super, super important. Here's a picture just to depict how the formal tetrahydrofolate dehydrogenase is affected by pantothenic acid. You see at the top, you've got the enzyme, the non-pantothenylated form, and you've got a coenzyme A comes in, and it facilitates the conversion to the active form of the tetrahydrofolic acid. So you can see that it's pretty important in methylation, which means that, you know, in addition to things like folate and vitamin B12 being super important, some of these other B vitamins, which play a slightly lesser role in that, are still critical because of these rate-limiting steps. This is again taken from the Linus Pauling Institute at the Oregon State University. Now let's turn our attention to how vitamin B5 in the form of pantothenate and also pantothene has a role in the management of blood lipids and cardiovascular disease itself. Here's a study that showed that 900 milligrams a day of pantothenic acid was shown to lower LDL cholesterol and triglycerides and reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease. And actually, that study was done with the pantothene form. It didn't seem to be as effective to use the pantothenic acid or pantothenate form. Pantothene supplements, but not pantothenic acid, were shown to reduce blood levels of triglycerides and improve cholesterol by 25%. And it's known that pantothene blocks the activity of HMG-CoA, which is an enzyme used for cholesterol synthesis, by about 50%, leading to significantly lower cholesterol production. And there's three different articles that you can refer to for more details. Let's take a look at vitamin B5 and lipids. A study at the University of Minnesota Medical School was done in healthy, unmedicated adults. It was double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized controlled, and crossover, meaning that none of the investigators knew which person had placebo and which one didn't. It was randomized, and the crossover means that they did one group as placebo, one group as not, and then they crossed them over and did another trial. Each patient was given either a placebo, 600 milligrams or 900 milligrams of pantothene for 6 weeks. And the overall effects, the overall results were that LDL-C, the worst form of LDL, was reduced by 10 to 15%. The fasting triglycerides were reduced by 20 to 25%. and the HDL was increased by 15 to 20%. And these are very significant. It's very hard to increase HDL. There's not a lot of things that do. So it was found that the panethene form, again, was used. And this was very, very effective. And there's the study if you want to take a closer look. Let's take a look at vitamin B5 and artery health. They did it. This was in rats. They administered cholesterol, high levels of cholesterol, 0.5% cholesterol diet, and 1% panethene for 90 days. And as a result, the total cholesterol levels were actually reduced by 64.7%. The HDL and total cholesterol ratio increased, which is good. The aortic area that had evidence of plaques was reduced by 18.2%. And on microscopic examination of those plaques, there was a reduction in the severity of the lesions, both in the aorta and in the coronary arteries. So obviously this was done in rats because it's hard to go in and do biopsies of human arteries while the person's alive and kicking. But this was definitely indicative of, oh, it was rabbits. Sorry, it wasn't rats. So, you know, whether or not this translates to people, you can't always say, but here's another study that was actually done in people. 182 patients with coronary heart disease had stable angina, meaning that they had the chest pains, but they weren't all over the map with it. They were given panethene, 500 milligrams a day for 3 weeks, and it had a favorable results on the hemodynamics, the working contraction, a relaxation of the blood vessels, on the lipid levels, on riboflavin and ascorbic acid levels. So these are some good studies suggesting that panethene might be a really good supplement to be given folks with risk factors for coronary artery disease. Here's another one that was a long-term panethene study. It was 1 year. It was a small study, only 24 patients, but they took people with established dyslipidemia. This is a particular classification of dyslipidemia, types 2A, 2B, and 4, either alone or with diabetes. They did blood lipid assays repeatedly at 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, and 12 months. And it was very consistent that there were consistent decreases in total cholesterol, LDL, apolipoprotein B, and increases in HDL and apolipoprotein A, the protective. So that's a good study for you to take a look at if you're working with someone with coronary disease and you want to reduce their risk factors. Let's take a look at how pantothenic acid, vitamin B5, works with fatty liver. Again, it was the panethene form, not necessarily the pantothenic acid. Some of these studies, they actually distinguished and tried both and found that the panethene worked, whereas the pantothenic acid did not. There was 600 milligrams a day given to 16 outpatients with fatty liver and high triglycerides. They were given for 6 months or longer. 9 out of the 16 panethene patients were no longer diagnosed as having fatty liver at the end of the 6-month period. The visceral fat, the fat around the viscera, around the organs, was calculated from CT image and it was significantly reduced. But the interesting thing was that the subcutaneous fat actually increased. So even though the ratio of visceral fat to subcutaneous fat went down significantly, which is safer, it suggests that what the panethene might be doing is transferring fat from the liver and viscera, so the organs and the liver, to the subcutaneous. And then the subcutaneous is much easier to then eliminate through standard weight control management types of activities. So this is really promising for folks with fatty liver. There are some studies with panethene in cognitive function. We can imply the effects of panethene on cognitive function when we look at the acetylation of lipids, as we looked at earlier. But they did this in rats. They gave daily injections of panethene, and it facilitated the learning process and activity levels in rats. It also find that panethene supports brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which is very supportive of the health of the brain. And there's some studies that you can take a look at. Some other uses of vitamin B5. They've done some large daily doses of panethenic acid that helped to relieve symptoms of arthritis. It was also used successfully for heartburn, ulcers, and candida infections, and with some success in the management of certain allergies. A rat study showed that a deficiency of pantothenic acid can cause hair to turn gray and fall out, but there have been no human studies or studies that show that the use of pantothenic acid actually changes gray back to normal, although you will find that some people are saying that there are no real human studies to date. Pantotherm is basically a dermal form of the, it's can come in cream form and be helpful in the treatment of minor skin injuries. So these are a lot of different uses of B5. Let's take a look at some of the B5 nutrient interactions, B5 nutrient and drug interactions. Nutrients that compete for absorption and transport are biotin and lipoic acid. So that would be a caution against taking high doses of biotin or lipoic acid along with your B5. Some of the medications that interfere are tetracycline, and this is true of most B vitamins, that the B vitamins interfere with the absorption and effectiveness of tetracycline, so it's used with caution there. And then Alzheimer's drugs, some of the cholinesterase inhibitors, B5 actually increases the effects of these drugs, so it can lead to severe side effects. So it's cautioned that you shouldn't be taking B5 when you're on any of these medications unless your doctor's supervising it. So some of the cholinesterase inhibitors include Aricept, Donepezil, Ebixa, which is memantine hydrochloride, Reminyl, which is galactamine, and then Exelon, which is rivastigmine. So these are the cautions and the interactions with B5.
Okay, so let's look at, well, how much B5 is really needed. Well, in infants, we're talking 1.7 milligrams, and 7 to 12 months, we're talking 1.8, very small doses. Think about this. We're supplementing people with about 500 milligrams three times a day when they have adrenal fatigue, right? So it's a lot more than the RDA. And toxicity is very low. We'll look at that on another slide. So we really need to be cognizant. It's really easy to get the RDA or RDI of the nutrient from food because food sources are quite high in it. However, for therapeutic uses, when someone has had a problem for a long time, or you're looking and saying, gee, I wonder if vitamin B5 will take down their cholesterol, let's give it a try, you're going to be using therapeutic doses. So children are 2, 3, and 4, depending on their age. We hit 14, it's the same for males and females. It's 5 milligrams a day, and the highest, of course, is in pregnancy and breastfeeding at 6 and 7. Okay, so it's not a lot. And if you do food journals with people, you'll be able to see that they have plenty of it, but they may need a lot more due to impairment of various cycles. So what kind of signs and symptoms might you expect to see based on vitamin B5 deficiency? Well, based on what I've told you its roles are and where it falls into, you might see that these symptoms make sense. Of course, fatigue, and we see it a lot in adrenal fatigue. And it's not that they're having less than the RDA of the nutrient. It's that their body needs so much more because they're spewing out cortisol like crazy. So you're going to see low levels of this vitamin in both adrenal deficiency or adrenal fatigue, but also in the alarm state and the stage 1. Just because they're making so much cortisol, they're depleting their cofactors. Okay, they're depleting their CoA because it's like working like crazy. Now, in that case, if somebody's under a lot of stress, you might actually see low cortisol. So here's the thing. They may have low cortisol because they've been converting it all down to cortisol. They may have high cortisol because they're not able to do the conversion and it's stuck there. And you've got to figure out, based on their symptom profile and also based on any labs you might do, which you think it is. And it's usually the more you see this, the more you get to feel a feel for the overall picture for the person, which one it is. So fatigue, muscle cramps, plantar fasciitis, irritability, so things that are related to the tissues not being able to calm themselves down. Hypoglycemia, cramps, heart palpitations, hair loss, insomnia, intestinal distress, joint aches, nausea, premature graying of the hair. That hasn't been shown as much in humans. There have been a lot of animal studies, and the human studies are inconclusive, but it can certainly be something to try. Restlessness and vomiting. So these are some of the symptoms you may see that are indicative of B5. And obviously, some of these can do, these symptoms, they're like other vitamins have those as deficiency signs. So the art of being a good detective with our patients and clients is the ability to understand how all this stuff works and be able to make differentials, right? We call that in medical school differential diagnosis. We're not allowed to use the word diagnosis per se, so we can have differentiation of the symptom picture, or differential assessment, something along that lines. But basically the same. You have multiple vitamin deficiencies, let's say in this case, that present with some similarities. So you're looking for the things that are going to point you more in a direction of one or the other. And when we're learning medical diagnosis, we learn to rule out or rule in certain of the differentials. So say you're going, does this person have a B5 deficiency, a B2 deficiency, a B1 deficiency? We have some similarities in the symptoms. They have symptoms from all of them. Yes, it can be all of them. So that's one thing to keep in mind. With a disease process, it's unlikely to be all of them. But also, you can rule out one or the other by what? Testing. Certain tests, but you want to do the right kinds of testing. You don't want to just do a serum test, because those are not always accurate. So, for example, like folate and B12 present a lot very similar. So if you suspect that somebody has either a folate or B12 deficiency, then, and we'll talk more about this in those sections, but if you suspect that, then what you're going to do is say, okay, what's the differentiation between them? How do I know if it's one or the other or both? Well, if you go ahead and do a B12 methylmalonic acid serum test or urine test, then you'll say, oh, it's probably B12. Does that mean you can rule out folate? No, you can rule in B12, but you can't rule out folate. And so what you do generally is you always want to give folate when, you know, folate and B12 together. What's the impact of excess? And we want to know this. If we're supplementing with somebody with 500 milligrams three times a day, and that's 1,500 milligrams, and the RDA is 5 milligrams, that's 300 times the recommended dose. And that may feel scary. But the issue is that they may need it, and the clinical results are that the studies show that they can need it. Not necessarily going to keep them on that for the rest of their life. These high doses of vitamin and mineral supplementation are usually short-term type things. And short-term might be a month for one person and a year for another. But if somebody's taking really high doses of certain supplements for many, many, many years, we want to get in there and discover, well, what are we missing here, right? What's missing in the diet? What's missing in the lifestyle? Are they still just so under stress that they can't bring the levels down? So studies show no known toxicity. Nobody's reported on, hey, this vitamin in above 100 milligrams a day is toxic, because the excess is easily excreted in the urine. But in very high intakes, 10 to 20 grams a day for 6 weeks of calcium D pantothenate, what caused diarrhea in some people. Not everybody, actually, because in some studies show that 10 to 20 grams a day didn't cause anything. So that's not going to be happening, right? Because you're giving them a gram and a half. You don't want to be giving them 10 to 20 grams. So it's unlikely that you're going to give people a dose that's going to cause them to get upset. However, there was one case of an elderly woman who took a combination of 10 milligrams a day, which is a lot of biotin, and 300 milligrams a day of pantothenic acid, which is not very much. But she took it for 2 months and then developed an eosinophilic pleuropericardial effusion. And that's like fluid around the heart and the lungs. So that's life-threatening. Now, was it caused by this combination? Maybe. Because we'll see that high levels of biotin can compete with pantothenic acid, but that was just a study, just one person. So it's really considered safe. That said, anybody can react to anything, right? You have something that's perfectly safe, the normal dose, the RDA dose is 5 milligrams a day. You give this person 1 milligram in supplement form, they react. And then it's a matter of determining, are they reacting to the substance? Are they reacting to the carrier? Are they reacting to the excipients? What's going on there? So let's look at the top sources of B5. Like we said before, pantoths, from the Greek word meaning everything. It's everywhere. These are the top sources, and I have them in order according to the amount, the percent of the RDA, RDI, that they have based on a normal serving size. There were some charts that I looked at that was like, yeah, but a cup of whatever, you know, in this case, I don't see anything on there that I would say that to, but they compare a cup of almonds to a cup of broccoli. Nobody's going to sit down and eat a cup of almonds. Why would you say almonds are a better source? That sort of thing. So plant-based mushrooms, all kinds of mushrooms, crimini, shiitake, and they're substantial. I'll show you the numbers in a moment. So it's really substantial amounts in mushrooms. So if you're giving them some of the medicinal mushrooms, if you're giving them, you know, mushroom stir fries that you want them to eat, good source. Cauliflower, really, really good source. Sweet potato, decent source. Broccoli, decent source. Beet greens, asparagus, turnip greens, bell peppers, cucumber, celery, avocado, lentils, and peas. And there are other sources, but these are the top sources. Mostly I look at the WH Foods charts because they base the government charts, and the government charts are way harder to look at because they don't make them pretty and formatted. So I like to use the WH Foods, but they're accurate. On the animal-based sides, it comes after. So if you're looking at the amounts, the plant-based sides are way higher, and then the chicken, turkey, yogurt, salmon, beef, and eggs come down below those. And you can see it on the chart that we're going to present now. How does food preparation affect vitamin B5? It's easily destroyed by heat. We've looked at a couple of other vitamins that aren't as easily destroyed by heat, but the pantothenic acid is very easily destroyed by heat. It's also destroyed by light, so you want to store it away from light to protect the B5 content. So if you have a supplement, if you have a powdered supplement, you don't want to have it in a clear glass. Sometimes you get your vitamins in, maybe you get it in plastic and you pour it into glass. It's going to degrade. Or the capsules, when they're exposed, they're going to degrade. And they can be lost in water when the foods are boiled or soaked. So that's it. Not that big a deal as far as food prep mechanisms. Let's look at some of the specifics. This is very small on the screen, but you have a copy of this and you can print it out on full page. But you can see that the animal products are down here in this part, and the others are up here, the plant sources. And this just shows the RDI.
Adding herbs is usually a very good way to get extras of a variety of different nutrients, and vitamin B5 is no exception. So there's a handful of herbs that tend to have high quantities of vitamin B5. Some of these are things you can include food-wise, and others are more therapeutic-type herbs. So the ones that are high in B5 are black catnip, eyebright, red clover, alfalfa, burdock, nettle, and yellow dock. The ones that are easiest to add in food form are obviously alfalfa, which you can do alfalfa sprouts, you can get alfalfa powder, burdock, which can be purchased fresh at the health food store or the supermarket, or can be purchased as a dried burdock, nettle, which can be oftentimes harvested fresh, and in places where it can't be harvested fresh, it's very easy to get it as a dried form and added to smoothies and soups and stews and things like that. And yellow dock doesn't have that pleasant a taste. It's more of a therapeutic type herb, but can be found in powdered form. Some of the risk factors for B5 deficiency, people that are at risk at not having enough, are people who are alcoholics, because number one, alcoholics generally don't take in enough B vitamins because of their restricted diet, and generally alcoholics are drinking a lot of alcohol and eating a lot of junk food to go with it. So they're generally not taking in enough B vitamins. Alcohol also decreases the absorption of the B vitamins, including B5, and the utilization of vitamin B5. People who are anorexic, just not getting enough calories, not getting enough foods, the B vitamins do suffer, and B5 is one of those. Also, in anorexia, it's a real severe stress on the body, and B5 gets depleted big time in stress and adrenal fatigue. Lactose intolerance, definitely a risk factor for absorption. Hypothyroid and adrenal fatigue, the conversion of B5 into FAD and FNM in the Krebs cycle is impaired. And then the very physically active people run the risk of low B vitamin status, especially B5, because of the stress it is on the body and also because of their increased needs. So people who are like heavy laborers or athletes, marathon runners, etc. So what kind of things actually deplete B5? Well, certainly stress depletes it. Eating refined foods, drinking alcohol, and then a number of different drugs in the class called beta blockers, which are used for cardiac issues. So you can read that list there. I'm not going to go through each and every one of them, but I would recommend that you take that list, and if you're working with somebody, you take a look to see if they're at risk by seeing if they're on any of these medications. So how do we assess the level of B5? Well, we know that the static serum levels are not always good. You could do a red blood cell B5, which is included in the Nutrival by Genova or Metametrics. You can do a SpectraCell Labs, which looks at the white blood cell levels. You can look at a diet journal to see if they're at risk, if they don't have enough in their diet, or if they have a lot of the antagonists in their diet. And you can also look at questionnaires based on symptoms and taking a good history. It's always a lot of things just boil down to taking a good history.
So let's look at supplementation. Generally, you're not going to see a multivitamin or a B-complex vitamin that doesn't have pantothenic acid in it. So it's generally available. But the forms that you're going to see in various supplements range from pantothenic acid, it may be called pantothenate. You'll see pantothol, which is an alcohol version of it. It has an alcohol tagged onto it. Very common in your multivitamins. Then we have panethene, which is probably the most effective form because it's the direct precursor to the CoA. So your body doesn't have to do anything to it in order to get it in. So the panethene supplements have been shown in a lot of studies to be effective when the pantothenic acid supplement did not. So in the case of actually the cholesterol lowering, the panethene was what was used and not the pantothenic acid. When they compared it, the panethene was far superior. And then the calcium D pantothenate, and that's the one that the study that was done with the 10 to 20 grams a day, that's another form you might see. You can get it in capsules, powder, or liquid. Liquid's a little harder to find. I've only found it on one place, which is in England, but they do ship over here. I haven't seen it in powder much, but I have seen it. The most common form is going to be your capsules. According to Dr. Lamb in the article I put there, he says it's best when you combine taking the B5 with a cocktail. He calls it a high-dose nutritional cocktail. Well, we know that for adrenals, vitamin C is super important, so that's a good reason for that. Also, lysine, proline, bioflavonoids, pine bark extract, glycine, carnitine, magnesium, fructooligosaccharides, glutamine, and ascorbyl palmitate. Well, he didn't have a reference on his site, but this is what his clinical experience has shown. So it's not necessarily a peer-referenced kind of a recommendation, but I just thought I'd pass it on, especially if you're dealing with people with a lot of fatigue and adrenal issues and some of the other symptoms of B5 deficiency. And there are our references. We've got our regular textbook, the Advanced Nutrition and Human Metabolism. As for most of the nutrients, we have the Linus Pauling Institute. They have really great stuff if you want to dig deep and look at pathways, etc. Then we have this other article by Dr. Lamb that I mentioned, and then a couple of other articles that have specific references. The bottom one is related to the Deborah Du, is the one that's related to that study with the woman, the elderly woman who had an issue with 300 milligrams of pantothenate, but only 5 milligrams of biotin. That concludes our presentation. I'm really excited to have shared this information, and I'll see you on the next nutrient.